Hello, I'm Madeline Taylor. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Vanessa Colantonio was a DJ at CITR in the early 2000s. In the last 6 months, she has produced a documentary on trans healthcare in Canada and used her personal experience navigating the healthcare system as a trans woman of color to move through the story. I called Vanessa last week to interview her about the documentary she made at CITR. When she picked up the phone after arriving home from work, she was distracted for the first few minutes of our conversation by her mail. She was holding a very important document, which she explained to me was a new birth certificate listing her real name and her real gender. She started to tell me about the long and arduous process she went through to get her new name and gender accepted by the Quebecois government. Vanessa then read out portions of the letter to show me that she actually doesn't yet have her official birth certificate. This is just a communique telling her she will soon be eligible to apply for the certificate after a few more steps and processes are complete. The rigmarole is incredible. I could hear the exhaustion in her voice and the amount of time that she's put into this process already after 5 years of active transition. Vanessa is a wonderful person, and this conversation shows in a very small way her thoughtfulness and dedication and hard work and what she's been through to live as her true self. So this is our interview.
I'm Vanessa Colantonio. I produced Obstacles and Outcomes earlier this year. I've lived in Vancouver for 21 years. I'm a professional librarian and a writer. And also, I hosted a show for 7 years on CITR. The show was called Shake a Tail Feather, and it was a show about classic soul music, so from, you know, the late 50s to the mid-70s, basically. So, you can hear that.
Yeah, tell me about it.
It's taken me close to a year to get an updated birth certificate, which if you're born in a different province, then you're actually living can be a bit of a hassle. And, of course, I was born in Quebec, province of Quebec, in Montreal. So they issued my original birth certificate. And so I had to update it, with my name and gender change, which meant I had to send proof that, you know, I've had procedure and all of that stuff. And they kept asking for more information, and I kept having to wait for them to get back to me. And when I called, there was nobody answering, and it was just ridiculous. But anyway, it took right through last year and into this year to get everything done. And then I was told to wait 4 months before I got this, but this seems like it's a bit early. So
that's so funny. So in Quebec at this point, you wouldn't have to have any surgery?
No, they changed that.
Yeah.
They changed that. They've gone in the direction of, I think, a lot of the other provinces now. But originally, you had to do that, and you know a lot of other things. Like you had to get a, you had to get an announcement in the paper.
In the paper?
Yeah, you had to just in case so and so is now named so and so, just for reasons related to debts and stuff like that.
Oh wow!
Yeah, you know, in some parts of the state, you have to go to court.
So up until this birth certificate, were you still legally known as your dead name, as you've called it before?
Well, according to Quebec Vital Stats, yes. Here, what's interesting is you apply to change your name, and that's one thing. But over the past several years, where I've been transitioning, they have done, you know, they've made some changes to your identification here, right? Your photo identification.
Yeah.
And that they came out with the service card a few years ago, and that combines your healthcare card with your driver's license or your BCID or whatever. And, you know, they were taking essentially two different departments and putting them together, and they both had different policies as to when you could change an M to an F and when you couldn't. So eventually they made those changes because of an 11-year-old who lives on Vancouver Island and was going to Bellingham to visit her grandparents, and every time she went over the border, her and her family, there was always a problem. So case set a precedent, and they made changes, finally.
Amazing.
But, you know, it always takes time for these changes to work their way through the departments and their procedures and all how they do things. And I suspect Quebec, even with the changes, you know, there's pockets of people in there that, you know, probably don't know the war's over, right? Okay. Sorry, I'm just reading through this very important note in front of me.
That's okay.
Okay, just give me a second, okay? Just a second.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so this isn't the actual certificate, but it's an official communique from an office clerk over there in Quebec, and it says that, okay, it's got a reference number, and it says the director of vital stats in Quebec has authorized the change of designation of sex you requested. Enclosed, you will find the favorable decision rendered by the director with respect to your application. Please note that decision may be reviewed before the Superior Court of Quebec. Listen to this. The decision authorizing the change of designation of sex on the act of birth will take effect on the expiry of the 30-day legal deadline if the Superior Court of Quebec has not received any request for review. The deadline is calculated as a receipt of the decision. I guess that's as acceptance. After the deadline, we will send you a change of designation, say, okay, in other words, the new birth certificate. After that, you will be able to apply for a new certificate or copy of an act of birth. So you see there's a couple of extra steps left. Please note that in that case, any certificate or copy of an act of birth previously issued by Civil Stats in Quebec is no longer valid and must be returned to us for destruction at the address given at the bottom of the page.
Wow.
There's no address at the bottom of that page. Do you see how many steps are involved?
Yeah, and
like
how...
This is just that they've approved it, and if the Superior Court of Quebec doesn't hear anyone basically who contests it, then they issue a statement saying that it's been officially changed, and then I have to apply for the actual certificate to get a copy of it.
So...
I've actually paid for it, but I have to actually fill out another form for it.
So who could contest this certificate?
Well, I have no idea in my case, but, you know, if you had a family that wasn't accepting or something, then...
They'd have the power to do that?
Oh, the way it's worded, it suggests that somebody might.
That's a little bit troubling.
Yeah, well, I don't know what to make of a statement like that. I don't think I need to worry about it, but the fact that it's actually there is a sign that, you know, I think change hasn't really trickled down to certain areas. Like you see, it involves civil stats, it involves the court system, it involves obviously healthcare over there, you know, all kinds of things. Like there's just so many people involved for one designation change, right?
Yeah, it's incredible.
So anyway, you heard it from here, and then I also have a copy of the notarized legal statement that letter talks about, which is in French.
Well, obviously, if it's
the French one has letterhead and the English one does not. That's something. Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
How does that feel?
Fine, thank you. It's just there's just so much work to get here, and it's just, you know, the way you communicate back and forth with the government over there is just ridiculous. I mean, you know, just getting to emailing back and forth was a problem, but, you know, calling for days on end and not being able to reach them, and then they called me always when I wasn't here, and it was always something else. They didn't seem to know what they needed, you know, half the time, so.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I would imagine it's hard to keep track of who you've spoken to and which departments and which.
Well, I had names, but, you know, it's almost like I had to prove that I was who I said I was and that this is what I was doing. It's like, well, the first thing I sent you was from the surgeon, right? So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway. So it's sort of like, a relief, but also just feels like a very long road to even get to this point where they're like,
yeah,
we've approved your certificate.
It shouldn't be that difficult. I don't think it's that difficult in BC. If I were born here, I don't think it would be that hard.
Why do you think it's different in Quebec?
It's just more bureaucratic in Quebec. There's just more steps. There's more people doing, you know, passing paper along a desk from one end to the other, right? So
yeah.
It's just more cumbersome.
So at the beginning of your documentary, Obstacles and Outcomes, you play a clip from the episode of Shake a Tail Feather where you came out on air at CITR.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could take us back to that moment and how long it took you to get there and what you were feeling at the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had been thinking about it for a couple of years before that, and I had started, that was from October 2011, and I had started taking hormone therapy in January of 2011, so it had been several months. And, you know, I was still, I think by that point, you know, I was obviously intending to come out on the air at some point, but at that point I was far enough along that I started to feel strange introducing myself, you know, by my old handle, right? And so, in fact, I would try to avoid mentioning my handle a lot of the time, and that doesn't really help because then people don't know necessarily who's talking if they're tuning in for the first time. So I chose that date rather arbitrarily. I didn't say on October of this year I will do this. I just felt, you know, approaching that show, I said, this is going to be a show where I do that. I decided I would do that on that particular Sunday, that earlier that week, and I did, and it was quite nerve-wracking, but I did, you know, I put together what I thought was a good playlist, but I announced at the beginning of the show that I had an announcement, but I didn't say what it was until I was done.
You can hear, listening back, the anxiety in your voice,
mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you feel, like, if you feel still connected to that person who made that announcement on air, or if you feel like a very different person now?
Quite different, actually. I mean, I was already changing at that point, like a fair bit, but, you know, I looked different. I mean, obviously it's radio, people can't actually see you, but I looked fairly different, felt different, but I, you know, I'm that much more different now than I was then. So, you know, I mean, 10 months into transition is kind of, you know, you're just getting started, really. I mean, you look fairly different to people around you by that time, but you know, there's so much more to do, right? Even if you don't elect to have surgery, it's still there's still a lot of transitioning to do. Usually, you know, around the 2, 3, 4 year mark, there's a fair bit of changes going on in the way you look and emotional changes and various things like that.
Yeah. So do you find that when I ask about difference, I'm asking more about, like, your emotional state and how you feel sort of within yourself? Do you find that there's the same amount of difference emotionally as there is in terms of your physical body?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And do you find that the change is more more centered in your emotional self?
At this point, yeah. I mean, visually, I'm not really going to change much at this point. I think I've done just about as much as I want to. You know, the hormones have done as much as they're going to at this point, or at all. So, yeah, I think there's been a fair bit of internal change as well. It's hard to describe, but, you know, I mean, I could get on the air live and talk about any of this stuff if somebody wanted me to. I don't think I would have any anxieties about it.
Yeah. Did you get any kind of a response from your listener base?
Not people calling in the station, but certainly people, you know, sending me personal messages online and stuff like that. You know, there's a few things.
Yeah.
Likes, because I used to post the links on a Facebook group to that I had with the show of all of the episodes and the playlists. So for that one, there were a lot of likes, you know, so that was good. But, you know, I still had a lot of other coming out to do. I mean, a few people knew at my work, but, you know, the official, well, actually, I had already come out to management and my supervisor in the union, but I hadn't actually made the changes. Like, we hadn't actually rolled out my workplace transition for another couple of years after that. So it was still kind of an underground thing at that point.
And what did that look like, rolling out the workplace transition? What do you mean when you say that?
Well, I mean, I told my supervisor, I told some other coworkers, but not everybody. And, of course, visually I was starting to change. And so people were starting to ask questions like, you know, initially you may not, to others you might not look well initially because your facial structure, not your bone structure, but, you know, where little things like where your muscle and fat displacement happen on your face, you start to look different. And people might, if they don't know what's happening, they think, are you losing weight? Are you ill? You know, they might think things like that. So people start to comment on it, or they start to gossip. And it had reached me through my supervisor, who I had already told that, you know, the people who were management at that time had inquired about whether or not I was okay. So I decided we would have a meeting about it, and we did, and they were fine. So, at that point, I told them, well, you know, I am planning on having surgery at some point later, although I'm not sure. I hadn't gone through the process of getting approval and assessments and all of that stuff for that. So, I just continued to change, and so that would have been 2011. So, you know, early 2013, like in January, I met again with my supervisor in management and human resources, and we made a decision as to how we were going to roll this out, like what kind of communication was going to go out to all the other staff. Most of whom still didn't know. I mean, some did. And how everyone was going to be told, like how the board was going to be told, and because it's a public place, you know, how we were going to deal with questions or possible complaints from the public, all kinds of things to consider. It wasn't just an office environment.
Mm-hmm.
I was running, and I still run a book club, so, I mean, that was pretty easy to tell them. I did similar to what I did on the show is, you know, I said, you know, after the, you know, that I had an announcement to make at the end of the meeting, and then I made it, and everyone was pretty supportive. So when I came back, I was away for a few weeks and just kind of getting paperwork and stuff in order. And when I came back, I had my new name, and, you know, I was dressed differently. You know, and I came in, and, you know, there were flowers in my cubicle and all of that stuff, so it was kind of nice. But so that's how it was rolled out. While I was away, I had them send a letter. You know, they sent a memo out to everyone, and I attached a memo of my own to that, and it went out into the communications books and, you know, into the email, you know, all staff email, and that where I was explaining what I was doing and, you know, what it was like and, you know, how I would be when I came back and, you know, if people make a mistake or they forget and, you know, all of that stuff, you know, like, it would be understandable because almost everyone knew me from before that. So
you mean if they were like misgendering you or using the wrong name?
Yeah, if they slipped and used the old name by accident, which mm-hmm. happened, you know, in the first 6 months happened a fair bit, but mind you, there have also been people who have been bang on perfect the whole time. So,
yeah,
you know, it varies, but, you know, everything's, you know, I didn't have to worry about any hostility from any staff members.
At one point in the documentary, you talk about when you started moving towards a physical transition, that you dealt with a lot of unanswered emails and phone calls in the medical system. So
right.
How hard was it to get information about transitioning, and where did you find resources?
So I knew about the transgender health. Well, now it's called the Transgender Health Information Program. But I knew about that, and I knew that, you know, there were counselors and stuff, and I knew that at one point there had been a gender clinic, but I couldn't remember all the details. But I guess the year before I made that radio episode, I was doing a lot of research. You know, I went on to Vancouver Coastal Health's website and printed off a lot of stuff, and, you know, I tried to get a hold of someone through the Health Information Program at that time. And, you know, there was an email, there was a phone that no one answered. I mean, this is a fact. There wasn't enough money for staff to, you know, staff that phone. So I would call and leave messages, and I wouldn't hear anything. I'd sent an email to a couple of people, you know, like if I tried to contact somebody in May, I wouldn't hear until the end of June or something, right?
How did it feel to have to go through waiting like that?
And not knowing, it was pretty nerve-wracking because I didn't know if anyone was ever going to get back to me. So, and at the time, I had some really burning questions to have answered. And more than anything else, I wanted to see people who had already transitioned and how they were doing. Like, were they happy? What did they do? What were their experiences? And most importantly, how did they know, right? How did they know they were who they said they were? Social media was fantastic. Before YouTube, I'm not sure what people did, but with YouTube, you had people that were documenting their changes and their issues from day to day. So, you know, day one, they like what they're doing. Day two, they can't stand it. Day three, they like it again. Like, you get to see that, you know, that doubt is actually a part of this, and not being sure at times is a part of this. And, you know, you get to see what it's actually like versus what the popular notions of a trans person and their transition are like, right? So,
Yeah.
And that was important, and there's such a lack of that kind of information.
Now, there's one thread that you actually mentioned has a very contemporary news event happening. There was a trans health clinic that was someone tried to burn it down. There was an arson attack in Ontario. I'm wondering if you could talk about
that. Well, it was in Quebec. Actually, it was in Quebec.
Okay.
Yeah. This is the actual surgery clinic, of which there's only one in Canada. And it's been in Montreal for over 40 years. There have been a few different generations of surgeons there. Okay, I think the current surgeon, Dr. Brassard, is, I think, the third of those. There was his mentor, and then I think his mentor's mentor before that. And there's another surgeon that's being mentored at this point, Dr. Boulanger, and they were there when I was there last year. So what happened was nearly 2 weeks ago, this coming Monday, somebody came in through a side entrance, and I think maybe one of the staff thought that they worked there. I'm not sure why they would think that, but perhaps there was some reason to think that. And they came in and began trying to set fire to the place. They came into the operating room. Now, there were no patients in there at the time. It was Monday night, and having been there, I could say that Monday night there isn't anyone actually having a procedure. It would have been earlier that day. But there are things like, you know, oxygen tanks and stuff in there. So, I mean, this is a big deal. Apparently, they also had a machete. And they managed to do, you know, some damage before fleeing on foot. The damage was about $700,000 worth. I'm getting this from articles I've read on this. I've tried to keep up to date about the latest on the investigation. I don't think they've found them yet. Now, the clinic is in an area that's fairly inconspicuous. You can't tell by looking at the building what they do. The whole idea that, you know, someone who does this is doing it randomly and it's because they're crazy and all of that stuff. It doesn't do a whole lot of justice to people with mental illness. But also, you know, it kind of shows you how low a priority it is, perhaps for folks in the media and some of the audience, media audience, that they would not consider, you know, something like this to be a big deal. I mean, it's,
well, to be a hate crime, essentially.
Well, exactly, and that's how the police in Montreal are now treating it. And what's unnerving is you don't really know, you know, if that person's going to come back. They haven't caught them.
Yeah.
And if somebody else will try and do what this person failed to do, presumably.
Well, I was wondering, I noticed that there hasn't been a lot of media attention around this incident. Do you think that's almost a blessing in disguise in that if you're concerned about copycats or people targeting this clinic in the future, that if it's not getting tons of coverage, that might be a good thing?
It might be a good thing, but it also reveals, here's the thing, is that, you know, if there is a problem with hate crime and a lack of hate crime legislation, I mean, for trans people in this country, and there isn't really, as we speak, there isn't a law that's been passed yet, despite the fact that there's been a promise from the federal government to do that, then I think people should know about that. People should be reminded that this has happened, you know, even though you might not necessarily get a whole lot of information. You don't have to give addresses and phone numbers away. But, you know, this incident is something that needs to be talked about.
Yeah, you could almost approach it similar to how publication bans happen with certain people's names, but they still talk about the core issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I suppose public outcry and a public statement about, a repeated public statement very loudly that this sort of thing is despicable and won't be tolerated is the only way to get rid of that kind of impulse for hatred.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is changing topic, but the music in your piece is very, it's used in a very interesting way, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you were going for with some of your choices of inserting jazz or soul music into the documentary.
Right. Well, first off, I mean, of course, the clip from the radio program from 2011, the music, the song that is the only vocal piece, I think, in the entire feature, is something I actually did play on the air, but I remixed it for the purposes of this documentary feature, because the way it originally happened, I gave the announcement, and then I was queuing up something, and I can't remember what happened, but I don't think the queue up worked properly for some reason. So I didn't want that to be the case here, so I found the song, and I blended it in with the announcement clip from that time, so I was able to kind of doctor it a bit. But as for the other pieces, they're all instrumental, and that's really what I was looking for initially. I was looking for instrumental music to put in that would kind of establish mood. And I kept thinking, what could I use? And I asked around and all that stuff. And then I decided I would just bring some jazz in, of different kinds, just some stuff that I had. I didn't really think much of it except trying to provide stuff that was good segue or good, you know, good kind of break from the talking, because you're getting a lot of information on it, and also as musical beds and stuff. So I just brought a bunch of CDs into the studio, and choosing tracks, it was really a question of looking at the titles, and even though there's no words, I thought, well, you know, does the theme of the, does the title meet, you know, kind of match up with the theme of what I'm talking about somehow? And they kind of vaguely did.
Yeah. Well, I just have one final question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider this an activist documentary?
It is a consciousness-raising documentary. I'm not sure if it's... I don't even know if it's quite that formalized. I think I'm showing my experience as a good experience. You know, I certainly am not an example of someone who's had a lot of hardship, and there are people who have, just going through the system, never mind legal, financial stuff. And I'm suggesting that there were points at which things felt very, unsure. And I tried to set that against, you know, how things developed and what other people struggle through. And suggested that, you know, being lucky, as I've been in a lot of cases, isn't really enough to sustain a healthcare system. It might be good for the individual, but it's not enough to... It's not a sign that things are working really, really well if somebody just goes through and manages to have an okay time doing it. But
knowing that that's not the norm.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of it's an education piece. I mean, I'm presuming the majority of people hearing this aren't going to know this yet, right? You know, they might know a little bit of what they've heard in the media, but they won't really know about the ins and outs. And there's still a lot of people that think that, you know, if you want gender confirmation surgery, that you can just go to your local hospital and get it done, right? And it's just not like that. They don't know that there's one clinic.
Yeah. In all of Canada.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that also takes people from outside the country, too.
Well, thank you for your work on this piece. I think it's really powerful and an important story.
That's good. What do you like most about it?
I think what I like most about it is your sense of humor when it comes through, mm-hmm. in your explanations kind of the intricacies of different clips, or expanding on different clips so that the listeners have a more enriched understanding of what it is that the clip is trying to communicate,
mm-hmm.
and putting it in context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that's it. That's all I've got. Is there anything that you want to add as a final remark, or...
Well, I'd say, you know, it'd be this. I hope this piece becomes something that somebody else can use in their pieces subsequently. I think a lot has to be done. I think our culture is fascinated with people transitioning, but after you transition, it's like no one's interested, and I think we need to hear more about people's experiences afterwards and the ordinary stuff, right, that's less difficult to sensationalize. And that way, you know, I think people... see that, you know, even though for all the differences and for all the particulars, I think that, you know, we just have and want regular lives for the most part, right?
Yep. That was my interview with Vanessa Colantonio, the producer of Obstacles and Outcomes, Trans Healthcare in Canada. To hear her documentary, tune in to CITR on May 27th at 9 a.m. You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral unceded territory of the Hukuminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes. These contain an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station between 1949 and the late 90s. With help from UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, over 400 audio files are now available for the public to hear and download. In order to share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiatives Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Friday at 9 a.m. for the next 6 weeks, from May 20th to June 24th, for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca, for podcasts and more information.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Colantonio. I'm a Black trans woman based in Vancouver. And this year, I'm celebrating two anniversaries. It's been 5 years since I started my gender transition. And it's been 1 year since my surgery. For 7 years, I hosted a music show on CITR-FM called Shake a Tail Feather. Here's what I sounded like when I came out on the air.
Courtney with Skate Now, off of Land of Thousand Dances, Volume 2. Off of 60s Girl Groups, some compilation that put out by Warner Brothers a couple of years back, or actually many years back, the Apollas with Pretty Red Balloons, and Lee Dorsey before that with Working in a Cold Mine, the Bobettes with Happy Go Lucky Me, the Dolls before that with And That Reminds Me, and the Kelly Brothers before that with Crying Days Are Over. And the show is almost over, and I promised I was going to make an announcement, so I'm going to actually make it now. This is not my last show, so you don't have to worry about that. The show's got some time ahead of it, but it is the last show under my current handle. I've been known as DJ Jason basically since I've started, variations of. But I am going through some personal changes, namely gender transitions. So my new handle is going to be DJ V, starting the next show in 2 weeks. I'm going to be introduced as such. And I still need to work on my promos, in fact, so disregard some of the promo, but the time and the name of the show and the scope of the show, the finest in classic soul and rhythm and blues, are going to be the same. So DJ V, i.e. myself, will be back in 2 weeks at 3 o'clock on Sunday with more Shake a Tail Feather. So anyway, everything else stays the same, but some things are going to be changing. So anyway, that's the announcement, and I have a little bit more show left. I think the Queer FM folks are waiting. As nerve-wracking as it was only a small part of my transition journey. On the other hand, navigating the healthcare system as a trans woman was a much bigger part of it. This documentary is about my journey through the BC healthcare system, both typical and untypical. It's also about that healthcare system and how it's developed in its service to trans people. Welcome to Obstacles and Outcomes.
Thank you.
When I came out on the air, it had been 10 months since I had been on hormone replacement therapy, HRT for short. Getting the hormones, namely a testosterone blocker and a synthetic form of estrogen, meant approaching a healthcare system with very limited resources for trans people. In other words, a trans health program with a few general practitioners, a few endocrinologists, a few nurses, and two psychiatrists, one in Vancouver and one in Victoria, all of whom specialize in trans healthcare, but are only funded to do so for too few hours. In fact, if you look at its history, trans healthcare in British Columbia has always been a somewhat precarious venture. This has been especially true for surgery for both female-to-male, FTM, and male-to-female, MTF, transsexuals. For example, assessments for surgery in BC began in 1970, the year I was born. The successful candidate then traveled out of province for surgery, much like they do now. Financial coverage by the province's medical services plan began years after that, in 1982. 2 years later, the Gender Dysphoria Clinic was founded by Dr. Diane Watson at the Vancouver General Hospital. But in 1988, after the BC Social Credit Party was elected, MSP funding for surgery was cut. And even when the NDP were elected again in 1991, it was another 4 years before that funding was reinstated. That is, to some degree. In 2001, FTM activist Lucas Walter reflected on this double standard for Heather Kitching, host of CITR's long-running show Queer FM.
I talked to a woman the other night whose deaf son had it all lined up with NDP government back when they used to actually fund phalloplasty for us. Back in, just before Vanderzam came in, so that would have been the late 70s, early 80s.
So back in the late 70s, the government would fund FTM surgery, but now they don't?
Well, yeah, they had it all lined up. They had the surgeon, they'd gone down for consultation, then Vanderzam got in and he pulled it. And so this guy was unable to complete the process that he'd already started.
And the NDP government never put this in after Vanderzam killed it?
Well, no, they didn't. At that, it just recently, I've been working with, with the clinic here, definitely, with the gender clinic, but that was just near the end. I started on my own because I found out that the surgeons, from the surgeons themselves, I found out that it is funded for factory model guys that need it.
So
they get some kind of surgical correction done.
In this interview, Lucas pointed out the irony of men with male anatomies, which he called factory model guys, having ready access to the kind of surgery that trans men did not.
So factory model guys who are born with small penises can have penile enlargement on the government, but you can't?
I don't know if they'd have penile enlargement, but because that might be considered cosmetic if they actually have working organs, regardless of if they're small.
Okay.
If they have functioning organs, I don't know that they would get that kind of surgery. But if they certainly botched circumcisions, which still happen way too many times to even want to think about, accidents, illnesses that have any direct effect on genitalia, I talked to the surgeons themselves, and they have said that they have been funded for those treatments, as did the head of plastic surgery out at UBC, Dr. Rick Warren. He also said that he knows of cases where people have gone to the same surgeon that I requested to go to. And with the backing of many prominent medical people here in Canada, I wrote to MSP and they did reject me based on, get this, MSP is funded by our tax dollars here in BC. We have an internationally highly acclaimed gender clinic here in Vancouver through Vancouver Hospital. And the MSP deferred to the Clark Institute, which is back in Toronto, which, for crying out loud, they're still trying to talk people out of being gay and lesbian there. they're very strong proponents that environment controls gender, and by controlling environment, you can change and control gender. And these are the people that MSP deferred to, and of course they have been publicly, they are on the record saying they would never support phalloplasty. I don't know why. They have very outdated information about what phalloplasty used to be, which was fairly horrendous. They've changed over the last 10 to 15 years. A lot of people are getting these procedures, and therefore the surgeons in Canada as well as other places are getting much practice. And I've been researching this solely, finding out that they've been advancing leaps and bounds.
Toronto's highly controversial Clark Institute, a 12-story psychiatric clinic, was founded in 1966. The same year, pioneering endocrinologist Dr. Harry Benjamin published his book, The Transsexual Phenomenon. Its controversial history would make an abundant documentary of its own, but a short list of troubling issues included the founder, Charles Kirk Clark, being a fervent supporter of eugenics. Doctors who helped give the Institute its dark reputation in transgender care included doctors Ray Blanchard, Anne Lawrence, and Kenneth Zucker. Stories told by trans people treated there are often filled with complaints about the staff's coldness, hostility, and usually outright refusal to grant trans people access to the health services they need. In 1998, the Clark Institute was renamed the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in an attempt to create some distance from its past. But its reputation as the ultimate gatekeeping institution followed right along anyway. It had long relied on outdated or flawed studies, studies that were often referred to by anti-trans hate groups and unaccepting parents of trans youth, such as the parents of Leela Alcorn, who committed suicide in Ohio in December of 2014. The Institute's influence went far and wide.
So now you say that there's a gender clinic here in Vancouver, of course. Does the gender clinic here support phalloplasty for FDAM guys?
They do. Yeah, they're swamped, needless to say, and so they were more focused on incoming clients and just getting them stabilized and assessing them and diagnosing them as transsexual, and were not taking the time to do the actual outreach research that was needed. Mm-hmm. I did take the time because it's self-serving. I want the surgery. I want to find out who's doing it well.
Mm-hmm.
I want to meet the recipients, and I want to see firsthand the results,
mm-hmm.
which is what I've been doing. I gave this information to the clinic, and they jumped right in the ring with me. They were also ticked that they were bypassed when they recommended my surgeon of choice and me as a recipient. MSP just ignored them and went to the folks at the Clark Institute back east. It's politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when you file your complaint against the government, are you filing on the grounds of sex discrimination because M2Fs get surgery but F2Ms don't, or are you filing on a sort of double standard whereby factory model guys can have all kinds of reparative surgery but you can't?
Well, both. It's the one and the same. I'm filing under gender discrimination, i.e. a genetic male
mm-hmm.
can have this surgery done, but a non-genetic male cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the genetic males are my control population.
Lucas, like most of us in the trans community still do, had to do his own research in order to navigate the medical system. In 1997, the needs of the trans community for adequate, up-to-date medical information and the medical community's reluctance to share it came into stark conflict. The flashpoint was at the 15th Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association Conference, held at Sutton Place Hotel in downtown Vancouver.
There has been a concerted effort to keep the community away. And these are the people that the gender community clinic serves.
The reason why we're here today is because this conference, which is made up of the doctors and the therapists that are supposed to be serving us, is inaccessible to the people that they're supposed to be serving. I mean, how can we dialogue with the doctors if they refuse to come out and listen to us? It makes me as a transsexual person believe that all they're really interested in is taking my money.
Several important presentations are going to be occurring here, dealing with all kinds of important issues, whether it's sociological or psychological or recent advances in surgical techniques. And I feel that the lower income transgendered of the local community.
I announced it this morning when opening this conference that we are now offering an internet journal which everybody will have access to it. Everybody.
That's not good enough. Everybody doesn't have access to internet. Now, if you are serious about hearing our voices, invite us in. Give us 5 minutes. We will make a speech. You have 3 days. Give us 5 minutes. Those individuals, we are the ones that provide you with an industry. Hear us. All we're asking for is to be heard. Well, it's not going to cost the foundation anything to let us in. 5 minutes.
I would think there would be no problem to really speak 5 minutes. And I would suggest that we do it in the, we will have to look in the timetable when that would be appropriate.
Yeah. It's such an obvious thing to me to make it accessible. It seems like something that people shouldn't, I just get tired of having to always be the one to say, look, I demand such and such, I demand this, and this is something that's necessary. It needs to be accessible. It just should be. It should be, and that should be a part
of
what
you guys... That's how life is organized, really.
That's not right. That's not the answer.
The association, now known as the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, or WPATH for short, is on much better terms with the community it serves. As an MTF, armed with my own information, I still found approaching the healthcare system pretty intimidating, and I'm far from the only one. Trans activist Deborah Brady cited an interesting statistic in 1997 after a seminar on service delivery at the Harry Benjamin International Conference.
One study in the seminar, 37% of women between the ages of between teen years and almost 30, I believe it was, reported that they had never accessed health care services due to embarrassment with a gynecologist or any of a number of reasons. And in fact, to support the lie about who they are, you know, that I'm not a transgender person, I'm a woman, or I'm not a transgender person, I'm a man, they would submit themselves to medical care, which was inappropriate, ill-advised, or harmful.
Vancouver's gender clinic closed in 2002 after funding was cut by the then recently elected BC Liberal Party. Chaos followed as trans people on the clinic's waiting list scrambled to gather together whatever information they could find out about what to do next. Miriam Jouara was a client of the clinic around the time that the funding was cut. She gave a vivid description of the situation to Queer FM.
So I'm wondering if maybe you can talk first a bit about exactly what is happening to the gender clinic, because the government said they weren't going to cut health care. Ha ha ha. So what's going on over there?
I just want to first make a disclaimer. This is really based on my interaction with the director of the clinic at a recent meeting that I had.
Okay.
And I had some questions for him, mostly after Joshua Goldberg from Victoria's Transcend organization sent a fax to the gender clinic, basically requesting some additional information, because we all knew something had happened at the clinic, but the rumor mill was running and nobody really knew what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought up some really good questions in that email. I unfortunately don't have it, but it's been posted on my mailing list if anybody wants to look at it. And I'll, you know, either can subscribe and have a look.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't know exactly what the details are. I gathered a little bit more information through my meeting. What we do know for a fact is that the Vancouver General Hospital Administration and the psychiatry department has decided to cut some of the funding to the gender clinic.
Mm-hmm.
The gender clinic is actually multi-purpose. They don't just deal with gender. They also deal with some reproductive health and sexuality issues.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a floor on the fifth floor of the Eklon Center, which is at kind of Cambion 8.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that they basically only cut the gender part. So the people working, most of the people working there are going to remain, and the space is going to remain. But basically, the facts are this. A number of people lost their job, which were their full-time positions. Two administrative staff, the nurse, one social worker and one psychologist, I believe.
Hmm.
I don't know all their names.
I was just going to say, you don't know which psychologist, do you?
I do know who remains.
Okay.
The people who are remaining are the part-time psychiatrists.
Okay.
That would be Dr. Robineau, Dr. Knudsen and Dr. Stevenson, and Dr. Stevenson is the director.
Okay.
And so these are kind of what we know for a fact from having talked to directly to them. The big question is how does that affect people that are already involved with the clinic and people who were getting involved with the clinic?
Absolutely.
And so the impression I get is that Dr. Stevenson has told me in person that he would not abandon anybody that's already with the clinic. But clearly, they're dropping the counseling and the hormone follow-ups that they do. And I guess they're going to encourage us to go out and get those services somewhere else.
Hmm.
And my understanding is that they're not taking any new people on anymore.
At all, for anything.
That's right. But we still don't know exactly. Dr. Stevenson has told me that within about a two-week period, there should be some kind of release information sent to every current client at the gender clinic.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know exactly what they're going to say. But right now, that's kind of what we know. Do you have any specific questions in particular?
Well, you've answered a lot of them, but I guess, you know, my understanding of how the clinic works right now is that basically they're kind of, you know, not exclusively, but people think of them as the sort of gatekeepers for how
right.
you go through the process of getting your hormones and getting your surgery and this sort of thing. So now if you're a trans person who's just starting out on this process and you want counseling and you want to get on hormone therapy and you want to get referred to a surgeon and you want MSP to cover it, what are you going to do?
Right. Well, we kind of talked about that. First of all, one of the things people should realize is that technically, and this is a big if, they should be able to get diagnosed, et cetera, from any psychiatrist in BC. The problem is that until now, a lot of psychiatrists have not been willing to cooperate because they felt that the clinic was the only place that should be doing it.
Mm.
Kind of one of those medical, I don't want to step on your toes kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But this may change now. I know for myself, I had to go outside the clinic to get approved for surgery because they felt that I wasn't stereotypical enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually found a psychiatrist in Victoria, Dr. Johnson, who was quite helpful in providing me what I needed. And he's MSP covered. The only thing I had to travel there was my only expense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that will continue happening. But the big question, I believe, is the funding for surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, since MSP based mesh has a kind of an exclusive agreement with the clinic about that, I guess it's going to be up to us, the trans community, and up to maybe, I certainly think up to us to lobby MSP to accept referrals from other practitioners.
In 2003, the new Vancouver Coastal Health Authority established the Transgender Health Program, which was not a new clinic, but rather funding for medical staff at the Three Bridges and Ravensong Community Clinics to work some of their hours offering the types of services that Miriam mentioned. I began my own medical journey nearly a decade later, but as intimidated as I was also desperate for solutions. The desperation went out, so I sought out the Transgender Health Program for support. When I first left phone messages with questions about how to get started, I got no response for weeks, even longer for emails. When I finally saw a counselor, I was able to ask the burning questions I had tossing around in my mind for a long time. What was surgery like medically? What was HRT like? Would it make me sick? What about surgery? How did I know it was right for me? What was my next step?
Thank you.
The counselor I was seeing at the Three Bridges Community Clinic recommended I attend a support group, which I did for a while. She then placed me on a waiting list to see a physician. It took just over a month before a doctor phoned me for an appointment. I spent the next few months being monitored by a doctor. I told my story at length over and over. How I knew I was transgender, my first memories of it, how often my thoughts were drawn to that fact, and the need to transition. At about 3 months in, my doctor asked me how I felt about hormones. I was ready. My next step had arrived. Before I got my first prescription, I was sent to get my blood tested to make sure my health was up to speed. When the results came back fine, it was all clear. I started taking a small dose of a commonly prescribed testosterone blocker called spironolactone, or Spiro for short. Then I started on a synthetic form of estrogen called Estradot, which, unlike the Spiro, was in pill form. The Estradot came in the form of skin patches, smaller than a standard size Band-Aid. Based on my discussions with my doctor and the extensive information that I was provided with, I decided that patches would be the form of delivery which was the least stressful on my liver and kidneys. Over the next few years, I would have my hormone dosages adjusted and readjusted, have regular blood work done, and keep my doctor up to date on how I was feeling about it all. The health care I was receiving through the Trans Health Program, with its partially funded hours at a community clinic, was the kind of arrangement that the Vancouver General Hospital and many trans health care activists had lobbied for in the aftermath of the gender clinic's closure. In 2003, Victoria-based activist Joshua Goldberg gave Queer FM a breakdown of what initiatives were taken to make sure that the province's trans people got the care that they needed.
Well, one of the things we talked about is that the clinic is creating a discharge plan for its patients. And its discharge plan is consisting of sending a notice to each patient's GP saying the clinic is reducing its services, is not accepting new referrals. Here's what the status of your patient is, sort of our shared patient. Here's what we recommend in terms of surgery, but that's it. And we said that's not enough, that most GPs don't know what to do. They've just been referring everyone to the clinic and don't understand, you know, well, who would I need to refer to and how would I find another endocrinologist to deal with the hormones or a surgeon to deal with the surgery, et cetera, et cetera. So actually creating a little manual of here's what you now need to do with your patients. They need referrals to these kinds of doctors. Here's how